On Sunday, September 3rd at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl presents a special rebroadcast of our presentation with drummer, producer, composer, and educator Lenny White. Join us as we discuss moments of his career, including his time with Miles Davis. That's Sunday, September 3rd at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. To WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones. This is a rebroadcast of a program featuring drummer, producer, composer Lenny White. There might be interruptions during this broadcast due to WBAI's pre-Labor Day drops or live phone call connections from the Eastern Parkway Juve celebration. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl, starting now.
I want some steam on my clothes. Maybe I can fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I want some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar in my bowl.
Thank you. Hi, my name's Joyce Jones, and I'm on the line with...
Lenny White.
Lenny White, thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl. I appreciate your being here. So, you're born in Queens.
Yes, Jamaica, Queens. That's
yes.
correct.
We talked to another Queens drummer, J.T. Lewis, and he was telling us about his remembrances of the Queens music scene. Do you have remembrances as well? Do you have thoughts about music in Queens when you were growing up?
Oh, sure. There's much talk about Minneapolis being a big hub. There was much talk about it back in the 80s because of Prince and Jimmy and Terry and The Time and everybody.
Right.
But the thing about Jamaica, Queens is Jamaica, Queens had a lot of music come from Jamaica, Queens, but not just in one musical genre. Jamaica, Queens, just to give you some history, back when blacks were upwardly mobile and had enough money to buy homes, they came to Queens and they bought homes. Count Basie lived there, Ella Fitzgerald lived there, Brooke Benton lived there, James Brown. There's a lot of different people that lived in the Jamaica, Queens area. Illinois Jacquet, Lester Young. And it was a pretty fluent area for music and musicians. And we, being of the younger generation, everybody was whispered and said, well, you know, Count Basie lives there. This person lives there. You know, so like it was kind of cool for us. And we just carried on the legacy. Run DMC, LL Cool J, Marcus Miller, myself, Bernard Wright, Najee. There's a lot of different kinds of musicians that played different kinds of musics. So coming up in Jamaica, Queens, it was really a thriving musical area.
How did you wind up choosing drums?
Well, you know, I wanted to play trumpet.
Oh, wow.
And then I'm not sure what made me gravitate to drums, but that's where I've been. And that's probably the basis for all kinds of music anyway. That was the original instrument, other than the voice.
That is true. People have said that the drum is basically the heartbeat of the band. It pretty much keeps the band pumping.
That's correct.
You're self-taught as well, right?
Yes.
I was of the understanding that you were teaching at NYU. Are you still there?
Yes, I am. Actually, this semester coming up, I'm going to start to teach a Miles Davis course at the school.
Wow.
In addition to my ensembles and private lessons.
Wow. So what will the Miles Davis course encompass?
Well, we'll talk about the social relevance of Miles and his music, and also how, after 1969, after recording Bitches Brew, how music changed. Miles is responsible for changing music three or four times.
This is true.
And after 1969, music changed for the most part, and it's been different since then. 1969 was also Woodstock. We recorded Bitches Brew 24 hours after Jimi Hendrix played the last note at Woodstock. Things started to change. I'm going to be talking about Miles before Bitches Brew, after Bitches Brew, and the effects of what Bitches Brew did, that music did, not from just the musical standpoint, but also from the standpoint of sociologically, how things changed, how it affected all those things, and how it affected all the different genres of music after that. Thank you.
Now that you mention Miles, I understand you play with several people around town before that. How did you wind up working with Miles? I understand somebody referred you to Miles.
Right, actually, I did a gig in Jamaica, Queens. It was a club called the Aphrodisiac, and I played there with Rashid Ali, who played with John Coltrane. Mm-hmm. Benny Maupin was on the gig, who also was on the Bitches Brew album. And there was a mutual friend that Miles knew and I befriended, and he played trumpet, and he said, "Has Miles ever heard you play?" I said, "No." He said, "Man, I'm going to tell him about you." I said, "Yeah, right. You know, everybody says that all the time." And sure enough, he did, and Miles gave me a call. I mean, I had played with Jackie McLean and Tony Williams, who played with Miles, and also Jack DeJohnette, who played with Miles, had predated me and played with Jackie McLean. So everybody said, "Well, man, you played with Jackie McLean. Next thing you're going to do is play with Miles."
Ah. Yeah, right.
And so, like, it was like following a lineage.
So you also played on, see, you'll have to say the title because I usually call it B-Brew. I was raised by a very strict grandmother, and I still haven't gotten over that. So on B-Brew, you also played with my first percussion instructor, the late Juma Santos.
Oh, sure, sure. Juma played with Jimi Hendrix, too.
Yes. And was that the first time that you wound up playing percussion when you played on that release?
Well, I mean, I played drums on that release.
Right.
There's just one tune that I played percussion on.
Okay.
And that was the very first record I ever did. So it was my first time recording, for the big time at least. So yeah, it was the first for a lot of different things.
You want to name some more firsts that happened there?
The fact of the matter is that I had been in recording studios. I had done little things here and there with like neighborhood bands. But this is the first time I actually made a recording that was going to be archived and left for the world. And I did it with one of the most iconic musicians in the history of music. So yes, it was a first for a lot of different things, and it was the beginning of a career for me.
As far as percussion, I know, as a matter of fact, in my saying this, I know that some drummers actually refer to themselves as being percussionists.
No, I'm a drummer.
Okay.
You know, you have to understand, drums percussion. They all come from the same source.
Yes.
One of the issues I have with people today, everything has become so departmentalized. Everything is like there's a name for this, a name for that. I mean, like, I'm a musician, number one. I play all kinds of music.
Right.
But my specialty might be jazz. And I do play drums, but that doesn't mean I don't play percussion. Drums and percussion are the same family.
Right.
Because someone plays so-called jazz musician, that doesn't necessarily mean he doesn't play any other kind of music.
Right.
If you consider yourself a musician, you play all kinds of music. And especially today, if you consider yourself a musician, you play an instrument, you play music, because there are a lot of people that make music that are not musicians.
Very true. Okay. So what was your call like when Miles contacted? Do you do the impersonation and everything?
I try not to.
Oh, no. Come on. Do it for us.
Because everybody does it.
I know.
And everybody's horrible at it.
And you know it's okay. You can be horrible.
No. But the fact is that Miles had a problem with his voice because of the fact that he had an issue. And the doctor told him not to use his voice at a particular volume.
I see.
And he got mad and used it in the wrong way. And it caused him to have this rasp. But, you know, I do have a recording of Miles in his regular voice doing a radio interview back in 1945.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, like, he sounded like a regular person. But the mystique of his voice being raspy the way it was, it made the lore and the legend of Miles Davis even that bigger.
True. But you could still tell us the story without his act.
Sure. Talk like that. And so, like, when he made a call, he said, I'm doing an interview now. Why don't you leave me alone? I'm doing an interview. I'll talk to you later. All right? Leave me alone.
That was very good. He was the one that reached out to you?
Yeah, well, he called my mom.
Okay.
And my mom took the phone and said, who is this? And he said, my baby. She said, I don't care who you are. If you don't speak up, you ain't going to speak to nobody. You know? So, well, he laughed. And I spoke with him, and he asked me to be over his house for, like, a little rehearsal. And I was there. And the rest is history.
Nice. mentioned you were living with your mother, so how old were you?
19.
What was it like being, I mean, were there other 19-year-olds laying around town like you?
Well, New York is New York. I mean, New York was like the Wild West. You know, if you were good at doing, it's like a gunslinger. People would come to New York and test you out. You're supposed to be bad. Let me see what you can do. That was the way. That was it in Jamaica, Queens. That's how we got to Jamaica, Queens. You had to be, see, it was a totally different mindset because you had to represent. You had to represent your community. You had to represent your hood. You had to represent your music. And you couldn't half-ass that. You had to be on point. And so the way that you learned something is like, you know, you had to be great because people will call you out if you were not. So Miles came to New York from St. Louis and wanted to play with Charlie Parker.
Right.
And he was young, and he raised his game so that he could play with his hero. His hero was Charlie Parker.
Right.
And he did, and the rest is history.
When you decided you were going to play professionally, did you have a list of people you wanted to play with?
I'm going to tell you the honest to goodness truth. Yes, I wanted to play, of course.
Mm-hmm.
I would write my name on the back of album covers.
Mm.
I still have the album covers. I could show you. I have my name written on the back now because I wanted to see that. At 17, I heard a record by Miles Davis called Seven Steps to Heaven.
Oh, yeah.
And just in actuality, Tony Williams was the drummer on that record, and he made that record when he was 17 years old.
Ah. Uh-huh.
At that point, he became my guy, and my goal was to play with Miles Davis. And at 19, I did.
Got it. Excellent. So were there any other people that you were definitely going to play with? Yeah.
Oh, sure. Of course. I wanted to play with James Brown. Actually, it wasn't that I had listened to Jimi Hendrix, and I loved Jimi Hendrix, but Miles Davis was the one who asked me if I wanted to play with Jimi Hendrix because he was putting together musicians to play with Jimi Hendrix, but I was in such awe of Miles. I wanted to play with Miles. He came into a club one night and he said, "You want to play with Jimi Hendrix?" I said, "Nah." But
oh my
now,
goodness.
In retrospect, I should have said, "Yeah,
yes." Yeah. Wow. Did you tour with Miles as
with
well?
Miles? No,
yeah.
No.
Okay.
I recorded with him, and then I was actually supposed to go out on the road with him. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very interesting situation. I was over at his house. We were listening to outtakes of the recording. And I said, "You know, Miles, I'm going to leave. I'm going to go into Brooklyn to meet my girlfriend." And he said, "Don't worry about it. I'll take you into Brooklyn. I'll drive you in."
Mm-hmm.
And so he drove me into Brooklyn, and he dropped me off. And that's the night he got shot.
Wow.
Yeah.
So there may be people who listen to this program who are not aware of his having been shot.
The fact of the matter is he was going to play a club in Brooklyn called the Blue Cornet. And supposedly there were people that were against him playing in Brooklyn and not playing the regular normal jazz clubs that were owned by mafia. So they sent a message.
Wow. Okay, then.
Yeah, so he didn't play for a while after being shot. And so that opportunity closed, and I went on and did some other things. And actually, what was going to happen anyway is Lydia DeJohnette, Jack DeJohnette's wife, was going to have her first baby. So Jack was going to stay home with her, and I was going to go and do. But the fact that Miles got shot, they didn't do any gigs. And by the time he healed and went back on the road, it was the regular band.
Upon leaving Miles, is that when you wound up doing Return to Forever? Or?
Well, no, I mean, it wasn't like I left Miles. I was doing other things at the time. And I had played in a band in San Francisco with Sheila E.'s father.
Pete Escovedo.
Pete Escovedo.
Uh-huh.
And her uncle, Coke Escovedo.
Oh, okay.
Along with Paul Jackson, bass player that played with Herbie Hancock and the Headhunters. And great jazz trumpeter Tom Harrell.
Mm.
And Neil Sean, who had played with Santana. So we were all in this band together called Azteca.
Oh. We'll be right back.
I was in Azteca, Chick Corea called me from Japan and said that he and Stanley and the acoustic return to forever with Ayato Morera playing drums and Stanley Clark on bass and Flora Purim on vocals and Joe Farrell on reeds. And actually the band was going to break up, and it was Stanley and Chick that were coming to play at Keystone Corner in San Francisco. And so I was in San Francisco working with Azteca, and I was between gigs, so they asked me to play a week with them at the Keystone Corner, and I did. I had known Stanley before, and I had played with Chick before, so it was the first time the three of us were playing together, and it was amazing, it was great. And then on the last day of the gig, on that Sunday, two guitar players from the San Francisco area, Barry Finnerty and Billy Connors, sat in. And at the end of that gig, Chick said, I want to start an electric Return to Forever. Would you want to do it? And I said, well, I'm here in San Francisco, so I'm going to stay and work with this band, Azteca. And Stanley went back to New York and did some gigs, and they had Steve Gadd play drums. So in this interim, while I was still in San Francisco, there was a manager by the name of Herbie Herbert that called me up and said, hey, listen, would you do some sessions with Neil, Sean, and Ross Valerie? And I said, sure, because I knew them both and played. And they said, well, we would like for you to be a part of this new band that we're starting with Greg Rowley. And by then, Chick had called me and asked me to come back again. So I said, okay, I'm going to come back. Mm-hmm. But the band that they had asked me to be a part of and they were starting was Journey.
Journey?
So I didn't do Journey, and I did Return to Forever.
Listening to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar My Bowl's the name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones. This is a rebroadcast of a program featuring Lenny White, drummer, percussionist, composer, and producer. And what you're listening to right now is Celebration Suite Part 2 from Return to Forever. No Mystery is the name of that release. It's a 1975 Polydor Records recording. And before that, we heard Azteca. That's the name of the band. That's the name of the release, which is a 1972 Columbia Records recording. And that's the name of the track. This has a lineup of many, which include Coke Escovedo on timbales, Pete Escovedo on vocals, and Tom Harrell on trumpet, and Lenny White on drum. Before that, we heard two selections from B-Brew. Yep, that's what I call it. We heard Miles Runs the Voodoo Down, where Lenny White is playing percussion, and John McLaughlin, where Lenny White is sharing drum duty with Jack DeJeanette. It also includes Miles Davis on trumpet, Wayne Shorter, soprano sax, John McLaughlin, electric guitar, Benny Maupin, bass clarinet, Chick Corea, electric piano. According to Lenny White, Joe Zavino on electric piano, Larry Young on electric piano, and Dave Holland on bass, Harvey Brooks on Fender bass, and Juma Santos on percussion. Before that, we heard What a Dream. That's from Lenny White Live release. That's a BFM Jazz 2013 release. And we opened our program with our theme from Nina Simone. I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl from the very best of Nina Simone. Sugar in My Bowl, 1967, 1972. This is an RCA BMG release originally recorded in 1967. This is from a 1998 compilation. Stay tuned for our On the Bandstand segment with our associate producer Hank Williams. and more Lenny White on Sugar My Bowl, right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar My Bowl continues.
Jazz fans, this is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for September 3rd. This segment features era listings of Sugar My Bowl guests so you can see them live. This week's show is a rebroadcast with drummer Lenny White, but we still have a fresh set of listings for you. And we start with drummer Roy Haynes, who's at the Blue Note on September 5th through the 6th. Drummer Jeff Tane Watts is at the Jazz Standard from September 5th through 10th with an Elvin Jones tribute. He's joined by saxophonist Ravi Coltrane as a special guest on the 5th and bassist Charnette Moffett on the 8th through 10th. Pianist Onaje Allen Gums leads a trio at Club Bonafide on the 8th. Pianist Harold Mayburn leads a trio at Jazz at Lincoln Center's Dizzy's Club on the 8th through the 9th and at Small's on the 13th. Looking a little further ahead, drummer and percussionist Will Calhoun is at the Apollo Theater with Living Color on the 12th. Bassist Ron Carter is at the Jazz Standard with Ethan Iverson's trio on the 12th. Vocalist Liz Wright is at the Highline Ballroom on the 15th. Drummer Antonio Sanchez is at the Jazz Standard from the 15th through 17th. Bassist and vocalist Mimi Jones is at the Bronx Museum for the Arts on the 16th. Saxophonist James Brandon Lewis is at the Children's Magical Garden, that's 129 Stanton Street in Manhattan, for a free outdoor concert as part of Arts for Arts in Garden series on the 16th, and he'll be at Roulette in Brooklyn on the 18th. Finally, pianist Barry Harris leads a trio at the Village Vanguard from the 19th through the 24th. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, full listings are on our blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog, where you'll also find reviews, features, and jazz news. And sugar is spelled S-U-G-A. Playlists and audio from this and previous shows are also on the website. If you're on Twitter and Facebook, look for us there too, where we would appreciate likes, tweets, and shares with your friends. And if you really like what we do, please help the station stay on the air by pledging whatever you can and consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. See the Support WBAI link on our website for details. This is Hank Williams signing off. With our bi-weekly schedule, we're off the air next week, but we'll have updated event listings online and be back on air on Sunday, September 17th. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on the Bandstand.
This is a rebroadcast of a program featuring drummer, producer, composer Lenny White. There might be interruptions during this broadcast due to WBAI's pre-Labor Day drops or live phone call connections from the Eastern Parkway Juve celebration. Stay tuned for more Sugar My Bowl right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar My Bowl continues. Thank you.
not your mama. Hi, this is Roy Ayers. When I'm in New York, I listen to WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web.
Oh, okay. Did Journey not last too long?
No, you know the band Journey. Are you kidding?
Oh, my God. You're talking about Journey, Journey? Oh, my
yeah,
Lord, no.
Yeah, I'm talking about Journey, Journey. What are you talking about?
Oh, my gosh.
No, it didn't last long, no.
Oh, gosh.
It was interesting because I sat and watched them inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yes.
I'm sitting there looking at these guys. I said, man, I should be there.
That is so wild. Oh, my gosh. I heard you say Journey, but it just didn't click because I'm thinking,
no,
okay,
of course,
maybe
it did. It didn't register. You said,
no.
You looked at me and said, yeah, no, you weren't going to be no Journey. No, no,
no,
yeah.
Okay, then. But I do yeah, so, I do notice that Azteca did record.
Oh, yeah, no, I did a couple of records with Azteca. Uh-huh. So I went from doing that, and then I went to play with Return to Forever, and do a lot of different other kinds of things, start producing records.
Yes.
And now I'm going to actually open up my own record company starting in September. I'm going to have a couple of releases.
Well, you already have your own production company, right?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, is that, now, you mentioned, because you're fast-forwarding, and I'm going to have to snatch you back, but I'm going to stay with you where you are, and you're mentioning being a producer. You produced Amina Claudia Myers release.
Yes, I did.
Ghetto Productions?
Yes, I did.
Is
yeah.
that the same production company that you have now?
Well, no. I mean, basically, it's the same person.
Yes.
So, I mean, you know. It's just under another name.
Okay.
You know, I'm the producer behind most of that stuff. My publishing company is Chinese Music.
Okay. Well, now that we talked about it, tell me what it was like for you working as a producer with Amina Claudia Myers.
That was great. That was one of my first productions.
That's what I was thinking.
Thank you.
Yeah, how I got into it. The fact is, you know, like you hired to play for somebody on their recording or whatever. And you go into the studio and you play. And for me, what was happening, there was this guy behind the glass sitting at the desk saying how I should play this music. And I'm like, who's this guy? And, you know, I said, man, I play this music every night. I know about this. And he was telling me this is the way you... And I didn't particularly like the sound that they were getting. So I started to investigate for myself. And I decided that I'm going to try this. And what would happen is, in me trying to learn how to write some music and write songs and tunes, someone would ask me for a tune. I said, yeah, sure. And I would give it to them. They say, well, I like the way your demo sounded. So can you get the same sounds? Mm-hmm. So in me doing that, I investigated that too. And so I became on-the-spot producer.
Wow.
That particular release, I had done some stuff. And Amina said, you know, I like what it is that you did. And I was asked, and that's what happened.
Now I'm going to go right back to Return to Forever, because how do we just talk about that and then just, okay, on to the next. I'm going to ask you a silly question. That hat, you had a signature hat. Did that hat have a name?
No, I still have it.
Oh, okay.
You know what happened?
What's
Quite
that?
Honestly, just a while back, I was in Boston. I'll never forget. I might have been playing with Joe Henderson, Stanley Clark, and George Cable and Joe Henderson. And I was at the jazz workshop up there when I was on Boston Street. And I said, I'm going to decide to wear a hat. And I walked into this place and I saw this hat. And I said, it's a great hat. And I bought it and I started wearing it. And then I wore it so much that like it was falling apart. And I decided that I'm going to get a hat made. I got a hat made, and I used that model, and that was it.
So how many of those hats have you had?
Well, see, now, the fact of the matter, contrary to what everybody thinks, again, I had a couple of hats made that were similar. And
right.
One of them I still have.
Okay.
But, you know, I retired it. I mean, I wear different hats now.
Yes, you do.
And I wear different hats in life, too.
Yes.
And as a producer, you wear a different hat. A classic example about what we discussed early on in our conversation, I might play drums and I might play percussion too. That's wearing two different hats.
So I've got a question with regard to your general use of brushes. I guess you use it when you feel that the song requires it. But are you comfortable with whether you use sticks or brushes?
I'm very comfortable with brushes. Very comfortable. In itself, using brushes on a ballad or whatever, you use brushes because it gives you a different texture.
Right.
But, like, there's a record that I produced with Bob James, Mike Manieri, Gatto Barbieri, Steve Burrios, and Andy Gonzalez. And we did an old tune that Cal Jada did on an album called Soul Source. And there's a Lonnie Hilliard tune called Tanya. Thank you. overlay brushes on that with Latin percussion just to give a totally different kind of sound. So I'm very, very comfortable playing brushes.
Okay. It's like I want to ask you more about Return to Forever, but I don't want to stay there. Now, with regard to Return to Forever, how did you feel about the sort of rock star status that you guys had?
Well, you got to understand, that didn't happen overnight.
Right.
And number two, it grew to that. I'll give you an example. One of the first gigs we played at the Bitter End in New York. And have you been to the Bitter End?
It was a little place.
Thank you. It still is. I mean, it's a famous place.
Right.
But it's a small place. And that was one of the first gigs we did. And then we played the Village Vanguard. And we were playing in these kinds of clubs. And we were playing very, very loud. But the fact of the matter is that we actually grew. And then the point that it became noticeably different. We were playing Carnegie Hall. We played Avery Fisher Hall. You know, like, you know, that's like, you know, 2,500, 3,000 people. And that
right.
was great to do that. But then back in 1975, they used to have concerts in Central Park at the Woolman Skating Rink.
Yes.
The Woolman's Skating Rink. Schaefer was doing a summer concert, and Woolman Skating Rink held 7,000 people. And they broke down the walls when we played there. And there were about 12,000 people. Now, this was a band that did not have a singer, did not have a lead singer, did not have a number one hit on the radio. And it was an instrumental band, 12,000 people. They broke down the walls in the 7,000-seat stadium, and there were 12,000 people up there. I have a picture of it that I'm looking at right now.
Oh, my. Wow.
That's when I knew it was different.
Wow.
I said, wow. This is a testament for this music to have a following. And it was not music that was designed to be played on the radio. And see, that's where I come from. And that's when music was made, and then there was a way to market it. Not marketable music being made.
Right. You didn't record the music to be marketable. You recorded.
And then they made it marketable.
Right.
That's the same thing that happened with Bitches Brew.
Mm-hmm.
Miles Davis made the music that he wanted to make. And then CBS, at the time, decided to find a way to market it along with Bruce Springsteen, along with Blood, Sweat, and Tears, along with all the other rock bands.
On their label.
That's exactly right. Mm. And then that's how Miles started to play sheds and big concerts.
Ah, I see. I see.
See? The music was made first.
Right.
It wasn't him going in to make marketable music.
I always had a problem when people would say that that's what Miles was doing and that's what Return to Forever was doing or that's what Weather Report were doing. They were fashioning themselves to play big stage. They sold out. Mostly Miles. They said Miles sold out. That's ridiculous. He was playing voice. He was playing his voice all the while, no matter what setting that when things changed with him musically. I mean, I'm telling you something you already know. But no matter what he did, he still had his voice.
Right. You have to understand. Miles Davis was his own man. He was his own man from when he was a child.
Right.
Miles Davis grew up as a privileged black man.
That's right.
It wasn't anything about him being poor. He rode horses as a kid. His dad was a dentist.
Right.
And so he was a privileged black man. And all through his life, those aspects of his life were present. And he acted accordingly. So Miles Davis played the kind of music that he wanted to play. He did it his way. Nobody asked him to play this kind of music. He did it because he wanted to do it. There's a big difference, you know?
Right. To not really stay on this, I mean, I could talk about Miles and especially talk to somebody who actually knows the man or knew him. I could listen to that all night long. But I would like to hear you talk about your working with Freddie Hubbard because I love his
name. Yes, sir. I mean, you know, Freddie Hubbard was an icon. And other than Miles Davis, Freddie Hubbard was my favorite trumpet player. And I got an opportunity to play with him. And that was interesting because I had played with Miles and done some things. And then I get a call, and it was Freddie Hubbard. And he said, hey, man, can you do a record date? And I said, yeah, with who? Now, I sounded as calm as I sound right now to him.
Right.
Inside, that ain't what I felt like.
Right.
And he said, yeah, that's going to be with Ron Carter, Herbie Hancock, and Joe Henderson. And I said, oh, yeah, sure, cool. But inside, I would say,
right.
I was freaking out.
Right.
Are you kidding? What? These are the guys that I listen to on records, and like I'm getting ready to play with them? Are you kidding me? What? And so I actually got an opportunity to do this record, and then we did it at Rudy Van Gelder's, which was hallowed ground. This is where they recorded A Love Supreme, where they recorded Empyrean Isles, all these records that I listened to as a kid growing up, writing my name on the back of these albums. And it just so happens that Rudy Van Gelder, before he died, said that Red Clay was one of his favorite records that he had done.
Wow.
Now, it was traumatic for me.
How so?
Because I had this bass drum that was made from an oil drum.
Oh.
An actual oil drum, barrels of oil. And a friend of mine had made it, and it was very unique. It was great. Elvin Jones wanted to buy that drum, but I got it before he got it. And it was very unique, and it had a real interesting and unique sound. And I used it on Bitches Brew, and, you know, it was great. But I took this into the studio to record Red Clay, and I hit the bass drum, and Ron Carter said, no, man, you can't play that bass drum. If you play that bass drum, it's too resonant. It won't get no bottom end of the bass. And so here it is. I get an opportunity to play with my heroes, and I can't use my drum.
Ooh.
And so Rudy goes in the back. He says, well, I got a drum we can use. He goes back and amongst all these boxes and all this garbage and everything, he pulls out this 28-inch bass drum that has the painting of a moonlit lake on the front of it.
Oh, goodness.
And it sounded like a piece of cardboard.
Oh, no.
And I had to use this drum playing with my heroes. And it was extremely traumatic.
Sure.
For me to do that. I couldn't listen to that record for a long time because I heard all my mistakes.
So when you listen to it, can you hear the cardboard? Did it sound like, oh.
But you know what? That was one of the top records in the 70s. It was an iconic record
in the
70s. And every day, because Freddie had come up to me with this song, Red Clay, he said, man, I need a beat. Can you put a beat to this? And so I found this beat and put it to the song, and it became a big hit. And then every time I would see Freddie afterwards, he said, hey, man, you made me $1 million. I said, well, give me some of it then, you know?
Right?
Yeah, don't tell me about that, you know? Hook a brother up.
Yeah, know? Right. Now, there's one recording, actually, that somewhere in between Red Clay and you're working with Miles, I remember you're mentioning Harold Alexander. Could you tell us about him? Who is Harold Alexander?
Roots.
Yes.
Well, that was between Bitches Brew and Red Clay.
Right.
That was the second record that I made. Red Clay was the third.
Okay.
And I do remember doing that record. I don't remember too much about it because it was probably way traumatic for me to think about it now.
Oh, okay.
I probably put it out of my mind.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I actually wanted to know about Harold Alexander because I wasn't really familiar with him.
He was a saxophone player. He was
right.
A great saxophone player and a great guy, too.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And see, the thing about it is being in New York and trying to make a name for yourself, you got called to do sessions.
Okay.
I did an Andrew Hill record that wasn't released for many, many years.
Yes, I saw that.
Yep.
Okay.
So things happen, and you happen to be at the right place at the right time. You know, you get an opportunity to do a lot of different kinds of things with a lot of great musicians, and they become part of history.
Well, I see that you play with Don Cherry and Pharoah Sanders. I mean, there's so many. The names are endless. But your projects in particular, your first release as a leader, I guess, you did under your own name. Recording release you did under your own name.
Venusian Summer.
Yes!
Yeah. not Venetian summer, Venusian summer. Venice is a place in Italy. Venus is a planet.
Now, how did you get the opportunity to do that?
Because you were already recording? Because it was the first time in recorded history that you had a band that was recorded to one label, and you had four individuals that were in that band that were recording on different labels. And this is what happened with Return to Forever. And so the opportunity to be able to record my own project was because of the fact that Return to Forever had a contract on one label, and we all had different contracts on respective other labels.
Interesting.
So I got that opportunity, and, you know, it was great.
I guess you felt ready to do it, and you knew who you wanted to have.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I used Patrick Gleason, who was, I had met Patrick. He had played with the M1DC band.
Yes.
And then I had done a record. I had done Eddie Henderson, who was the trumpet player with M1DC.
Yes.
And I had done Eddie Henderson's record along with the whole M1DC band. It was the M1DC band with Herbie, Buster, Papo, Benny,
Jabali,
and Billy Hart.
Yeah.
And me. So two drummers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And Eddie Henderson's record was called Realization. And so I met Pat back then, and I wanted to use Pat on a project that I did. So Pat was a great synthesist.
Yes.
And I wanted to use orchestra in my music. And, you know, I couldn't afford to use a real orchestra, so basically what we did is we recreated an orchestra. But this was before polyphonic synthesizers. Now, what polyphonic means, it means that like a piano, when you play a piano, you play a chord.
Mm-hmm.
You play five notes. You hear five individual notes.
Right.
But with monophonic synthesizers, meaning that you have 88 keys and you can play each different note for each key, but you can't play two keys and have two different notes.
Oh.
You can't play a chord on a monophonic synthesizer. You can only play one tone at a time.
Okay. Yeah.
And so we created an orchestra using a synthesizer that you could only play one tone. So if you're going to have a 100-piece orchestra, you have to take 100 takes of playing one note.
Good Lord.
And so that's what we did.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it was kind of interesting. It was I recreated an orchestra with Pat before polyphonic synthesizers.
Wow.
And it was great.
Wow. How long did that take, do you know?
A long time.
Yes.
A long time. You know, I just saw a short documentary the other day that said that the Beatles spent 330 hours doing Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Mm. I think this is an anniversary year.
Yeah, what's interesting is in a year and a half, in 2019, it will be 50 years since we recorded Bitches Brew.
Wow.
Yeah, 50 years.
So is there anything planned?
I was actually talking with the family, and there's a possibility.
Okay.
I don't know yet.
Sure.
But there's talk of it.
Okay. I had heard somewhere that you were actually working on, not sure whether it's going to be a film, documentary. Well, you have interviews to chronicle the concept that is called jazz rock fusion.
Yes, I do. I have a bunch of interviews. I started to do it a few years ago. And then what happened was I got into somewhat of a snag because when I talked about it with people, they said, well, do you have a director? And because these are friends of mine, people I know, I would just go and sit down and talk with them. We'd have conversations about things in the music that we did together or that. Basically, how I started it is that Bitches Brew is the album that kind of defined jazz rock fusion. I mean, actually, Tony Williams' Lifetime, Emergency, that record,
yes,
I believe, is the first real fusion jazz rock album.
Okay.
But Bitches Brew really defined what jazz rock was going to become.
Now, some people say it was in a silent way.
Well, no, see, but they could say that.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't argue that.
Uh-huh.
But got to understand a couple points. In a Silent Way was basically two or three songs that were cut up and made much longer than they were. I mean, they didn't have a whole lot of music. And although it did kind of start a movement, direction. It really took shape with Bitches Brew. Bitches Brew,
okay.
You know, you had like 13 musicians
right.
in the studio at the same time. You had different personalities
mm-hmm.
at the same time coming together to make one collective consciousness. It was the most African album that Miles made to me in the concept of what and how that music was made, put together and created. And so the thing about it, which was kind of interesting, which I started to use as the premise for my movie, was from that record, there was one person from all the seminal jazz rock fusion band. From Mahavishnu Orchestra, there was John McLaughlin. From Return to Forever, there was myself and Chick Corea. From Weather Report, there was Wayne Shorter and Joe Zawinul. From Headhunters, there was Benny Maupin. And from Tony Williams' Lifetime, there was Larry Young, who played on there. And John McLaughlin, who played on there.
Oh, there's also Billy Cobham for Mahavishnu.
No. Billy Cobham did not play on Bitches Brew. This is I'm gonna make something really clear right now.
Oh, okay.
Let everybody know this right now. I'm gonna put everybody on blast right
okay.
now. And the fact is that the only drummers that played on the Bitches Brew sessions, which was three sessions in August of 1969, was Jack DeJohnette, myself, and on one tune, Miles Runs the Voodoo Down, was Don Elias
right.
playing my drum kit. And I played percussion along with Juma on Miles Runs the Voodoo Down. If any other musician utters and tells you that they played on Bitches Brew, they're lying.
Well, see, I'm looking at, there are other dates for these sessions. There's a January 27th and January 28th. Billy
that
Cobham.
Wasn't Bitches Brew. It wasn't Bitches Brew.
Okay.
I'm telling you.
Okay.
Look. Okay. Miles Davis is dead. Tia Macero is dead. But Miles Davis was the artist. Tia Macero was the producer. Now, there's a whole lot of other people that were on those mm-hmm. three sessions that will agree with me because mm-hmm. I'm telling you the truth.
Sure.
Now, there were other sessions after that in January or March or whatever you want to call it.
Right.
In 1970
right.
or whatever, that were not Bitches Brew. Bitches Brew was done in August of 1969, and that's it.
Okay.
I have spoken.
Oh, you certainly have.
That's what it is.
I hear you. And, you know,
I got kind of pissed, man. Mm. A lot of cats will say, man, yeah, I played on Bitches. They didn't play on no Bitches Brew.
They
were not there.
Okay.
No.
Okay. So I'm not disputing you. I certainly can't. I am not qualified. I was not there. But what I am reading is from and this was probably a marketing concept.
Yeah,
and
it,
they were probably just selling this under the name, but they call it the Complete B-Brew Sessions.
I like it. You won't say the word.
I told you I don't say that.
You know what happened?
What?
That, like, when it came out, people said, what's the name of the album that you recorded with Miles? I said, Bitches Brew. Oh, they said, Witches Brew? I said, no, Bitches Brew. Oh, Witches Brew? I said, no, Bitches Brew. That's the name of the record. And Miles' brother, Vernon, Miles' nephew, Vince Wilburn, he introduced me to Vernon. He said, Uncle Vernon, this is Lenny White. He played on Bitches Brew with Uncle Miles.
Uh-huh.
And Vernon said, oh, I hated the title of that record.
So
I can understand you not saying it.
I told you, I was raised by a very strict grandmother, and it just stuck. So
right. Understood.
And like I said, it probably was a marketing thing, you know,
of
that they decided
was.
To throw all yeah. those sessions into a complete session.
Right. And what's ironic is that on the internet, there are the outtakes. I got an opportunity to go back into the studio and listen to the takes unedited and uncut. And, you know, I heard it. And, yes, there are takes that are different than what you hear on the actual album. But it was done in 3 days. And anything other than that, it was a marketing plan because it became successful to say that it was a part of Bitches Brew. That's not the case.
Okay. Yeah, they actually refer to these selections as being previously unreleased. So,
yeah,
I hear you. I get it. I am not trying to take anything away. Lord knows. So, there's a group we need to talk about. 29.
Oh, yes.
Tell me about that. How did that exist?
Well, what happened is I needed to have a name for my band at the time, and I was 29 at the time.
That's what I thought.
That's the way that goes. That's what happened.
But tell me about the band. Tell the listeners about the members and its formation.
Well, it started with guys from my neighborhood. An absolutely talented genius from my neighborhood who went to school with my brother by the name of Donald Blackman.
Yes.
Played keyboards. And someone that everybody should know now because he's a household name and one of the great bass players today, Marcus Miller. And a great guitarist who plays on everybody's records, who has played on everybody's records, by the name of Nick Morrock. He's a guitarist that also played with Jean-Luc Ponty.
Mm.
Jamie Glazer played. Eddie Martinez, who played with LaBelle, and he played with Robert Palmer. Great, great guitarist, Eddie Martinez. Barry Sunjohn was his Barry Johnson.
Yes.
Who was a bass player that is from Jamaica, Queens. Denzel Miller from Jamaica, Queens. Bernard Wright was in there also.
Yes.
I mean, there's a bunch of great musicians from the Jamaica, Queens area. Jocelyn Smith, who's a great vocalist. She went to school that my mom taught at, and my mother said, you need to hear this girl.
Oh.
And so there were a lot of people.
I see two other vocalists, Carla Vaughn and Jocelyn.
Oh, Carla Vaughn. Yeah, Carla Vaughn used to be
and Lynn Davis.
With Earth, Wind & Fire.
Oh, okay.
And Lynn Davis. Yeah, Lynn Davis was a great vocalist from the Los Angeles area that sang on a lot of sessions. But, you know, there's actually another vocalist there that was on one of those records that you don't know that she was on the record.
Oh.
But if you look and see, you'll see. And it was one of the first records she ever did.
Oh.
She's from Denver. And Larry Dunn, who
with Earth, Wind & Fire.
Yes, who was with Earth, Wind & Fire.
Uh-huh.
He was
keyboardist and music director. Oh, yes, I saw.
And his friend, singer from Denver, we also used on some of those early records. And you might know her today as being Diane Reed.
I knew you were going to say that. Yes. Yes. She was a guest on our show, and she did mention how she was in a group with Larry.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Okay. That's great.
Have you ever heard the version of It Was a Very Good Year that I did with her?
No.
It's on my album called Edge. You have to listen to her sing It Was a Very Good Year, you know, the Frank Sinatra.
Yes.
You have to listen to the version that we did. It's beautiful. As a kid, I used to love listening to that. So I listened to a lot of different kinds of music as a kid. And I was influenced by all the different kinds of music that I listened to. And I still am influenced by all those different kinds of music. And I tried to put something from all the different kinds of musical genres that I've been exposed to in my productions.
Mm-hmm. There was a time when listening to the radio, you could hear all types of music on the
same
station.
That's
and
correct.
I've heard you talk about this, and that is something that bothers me. That's what I grew up with. I grew up with listening to all types of music. It was available on the same station.
That's right. Sometime on the same show.
Exactly. Exactly.
But you see, we grew up with that, and that's mm-hmm. what makes us the very deep-rooted and, I don't want to say complex, but interesting people that mm-hmm. we are. Yeah, I mean, multifaceted.
I mean,
that's because our culture is multifaceted. I mean, it has many angles, it has many roots, and it makes us interesting people. And that's what the music has gotten away from. And this is what I'm going to hope to bring back with the releases that I put out. I'm not interested in making marketable music. I'm interested in making music and then finding a way to market it.
Well, I noticed the last time I saw you was at Grant's Tomb. And
right.
You weren't playing. You were enjoying the music. But I noticed when, you know, Antoine Roney was there, his son Kojo was on drums, William Spaceman Patterson was on guitar, and they had a bassist whom I don't know, but it was a great combo. Antoine Roney had a really nice band. But I noticed the audience members, they were complaining because, especially when William Spaceman Patterson was playing guitar, he said, that's not jazz. I'm like, oh, no. In 2017, people are still making those noises.
Yeah, you know, it's unfortunate. And the word ignorant is not a derogatory word.
No.
And used in the proper sense. Basically, what it means is that people don't know.
Exactly.
They're misinformed and they don't know.
Exactly.
And there are a lot of ignorant people. And the problem is they don't spend the time and the effort to do the research to find and fill the gaps that they have in their information. The fact that Billy Spaceman Patterson, who I've known for years, we mm-hmm. played together in band, what does somebody in the audience need to hear for it to be quote-unquote jazz?
What I think the people who were doing it were probably stuck. You know how at some of the Jazzmobile concerts that there are dancers sometimes? They sort of jitterbug or what have you. And I think that that's what that person was experiencing. It's like, since it wasn't a jitterbug song, it couldn't be jazz.
You know? Yeah, but Billy was playing the blues.
Exactly.
You know, and you can't play jazz unless you play the blues.
Exactly.
You know, what's unfortunate is people don't spend the time to inform themselves. And they buy into rhetoric.
Right.
And things that they've been told, they accept things that they've been told as opposed to going out and doing the research for themselves.
Exactly.
They would understand, and that's been a problem, and that's what's fragmented the black community when it comes to music. Because, you know, like the young kids think that hip-hop is their music and blues and jazz is not their music.
Right.
That's their parents' music.
Right. Well, their grandparents' music. Yeah. Great-grandparents.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate that that's the case. I would really wish that we would take more responsibility, and instead of someone telling you what the music is, you find out for yourself what the music
is. I've definitely spoken to people, and they will not approach something unless they've seen a review in a certain newspaper. Like, that newspaper knows the answer to all.
Right, and somebody knows more than you know about your own music.
Yes.
That makes no sense. I mean, you know, from the true African tradition, if you want to find out about your tribe, you ask an elder.
That's all. Unfortunately, as we're talking, you will have completed a run at the Hudson Valley Jazz Festival.
Yeah, I played there on Saturday.
What did the people miss?
Well, they missed live musicians playing music, you know, and doing what has always been and will always be the real source of music. In today's world, the music industry is for young people, but musicians will always make music.
Your site, your website.
Oh, forget that.
Yeah, it's like, I'm looking, it's like, what is going on?
My Facebook page
is
better. I'm doing so much that I had to hire somebody to just talk about the other things that I'm doing. But, you know, me trying to get this Miles Davis chorus together and getting these releases together for this label, it's a lot on my plate. I'm producing some artists. I'm going to do a spoken word album of women called She Speaks.
What? No. Do you want to share some of the women that are on there?
Nope.
No.
I'm not talking about it.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. Okay.
No. Okay. I'm not gonna say nothing about it right now. I'm gonna wait. I'm gonna come out and find out what it is.
All right. Fine. Yeah. Be that way.
I'm trying to create. I mean, let me do something and then talk about it. It's going to be a spoken word project, and it's going to be called She Speaks. And right now, it's supposed to be just women talking about various different aspects of being a woman in the 21st century. We'll see.
Okay. You're saying your Facebook page is how people can keep up with you?
Yeah, right now.
Well, thank you so much, Lenny White. I appreciate the time that you spent with us, all of this time, because I realized, I looked at my clock and said, ooh, it's later than I expected. But I appreciate your generosity of time.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
And have a great time.
All right, then. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And you're listening to the closing moments of Shige Mabo. My name's Joyce Jones, and I have to work really fast here. What you're listening to right now is Climax Theme for Astral Pirates, Lenny White's Adventures of Astral Pirates. This is a Elektra Records 1978 release. Before that, we heard an excerpt from Eddie Henderson's Revelation Realization from his 1973 Capricorn Records release, Realization. Before that, we heard Chicken Fried Steak from Lenny White's Venetian Summer, his debut release as a leader on Nemporor Records, 1975 release. Before that, we heard Tanya from Lenny White. The Lenny White Collection is the name of the release. This is a 2002 Hip Hop Records recording. Before that, we heard Amina Claudine Myers. Lenny White produced In Touch release. That was a BMG Novus 1998. First Sunday is the name of that track. Stay tuned for a special on Nuevo Alternativo with a focus on carnival music. Coming up next, right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web.
Hello, bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.